Good evening. This is Life Rattle, the story show. I'm your host, Lori Callis. Tonight on Life Rattle number 1195, we bring you two Life Rattle classics written and read by Kate Scroggie. This week, I searched through the Life Rattle archive of stories on cassette tape, looking for material suitable to acknowledge upcoming St. Patrick's Day. Kate Scroggie's story, Big Potatoes, caught my eye. I connected the potatoes to the Great Famine, to the Irish, to St. Paddy. Though the connection to St. Patrick's Day is a bit of a stretch, I did rediscover some fine writing. The two stories you will hear tonight, written and read by Kate Scroggie, and the two stories we will broadcast next week were recorded and broadcast by Arnie Achtman in 1991. Our records from the earliest years of the Life Rattle radio program are incomplete. Unfortunately, I cannot locate any further information for tonight's writer. So please, if you are out there, Kate Scroggie, get in touch with us. Let's listen now to tonight's first story, Big Potatoes, written and read by Kate Scroggie.
Big Potatoes by Kate Scroggie. I sit on our worn, flowered hide-a-bed couch in the TV room. It's Sunday, 11 o'clock in the morning, and I've just poured another cup of coffee. A pile of two-week-old laundry waits to be washed in my basement room, two floors down. I'm not in the mood to lug it to Cabbage Town laundromat and to waste the afternoon reading back issues of Good Housekeeping while my load tumbles dry. It's overcast outside the TV room's single window. I can feel moistness in the air. Rain is on its way. I push the on button on my Zenith remote. Zap! The tube comes alive. An Italian news program flashes into view. I flick the channel. Cartoons not popular enough to make it onto Saturday morning programming air. Impatiently, I start the remote at channel 2. And pump to channel 36 to see if there's an interesting first-choice movie. No luck. Nothing but a filler in between shows on how pioneers spun wool. I switch to 29. Much music. Again, nothing. Just country western videos with unfamiliar stars crooning on dusty open plains. I zoom down the channel numbers, this time from 36. The Saturday Star sits next to me on the couch. I scan the bold red headlines. The newspaper is still crisp and orderly. No one has opened it yet. The front page has a photo of a crumpled car and an article on an accident on the 400, killing three adults and a child. I turn to the entertainment section, intrigued by the interview on Madonna by Carrie Fisher. I alternate my attention between the screen and the pages, pushing the control buttons to 27. CNN. American stock news. Boring. I shut the entertainment section and fold it neatly along its creases and pull out the life section. I read quirky medical facts like how schizophrenics tend to be born to mothers who suffered with flu during their fifth month of pregnancy. I sip my coffee, cool enough now to drink safely without burning my tongue, and search for a cigarette. I flick the channel again. It zooms from 26 to 16 on the magic box in seconds. I leave it at a commercial for Zest soap and return to life. I turn to page 3 to read Ann Landers and my horoscope for Sunday. I don't read the one for Monday because I'm afraid it will influence my decisions too much. The power of positive thinking is our topic for today, blares my TV. Distracted, I take my eyes off the Ann Landers column about a drinking mother of two. I focus my attention on the set and light up my cigarette. It's probably one of those half-hour commercials that guise as talk shows, selling gimmicky cassettes on weight loss or risk-free money-making schemes. I'm wrong. It's a Sunday morning religious show. I should have known. They dominate this time slot. I go back to the paper, but again, the box's voice booms. The power of positive thinking is within us all. This time, it sucks me in for a closer listen. Maybe I'll learn something. I watch the minister dressed in black and purple robes. I've seen his face before. He's one of those few popular preachers that's still unscathed by bad press. His face is like a skull with skin on it, but not scary looking. His eyes are warm and glowing, and he reminds me of a kind grandfather. He is respectable and seems to orate earnestly, clearly, without emphasizing himself by swinging a Bible in his hands. He doesn't wail or hit people on the head to cure them of some incurable disease in the name of Jesus. The minister looks at me square in the eyes and says, "No one knew the power of positive thinking better than David." Images of David slingshotting Goliath flash in my head. "Yes, let me tell you a story about the power of positive thinking," says the preacher. He clutches his oak podium and pauses. This story is about two potato farmers, a seemingly good one and a seemingly lazy one. I sip my coffee. I'm hooked. I want to know about this power of positive thinking and what it has to do with potato farmers. The camera pans to his congregation. They're hooked too. The church is packed to capacity with good folk. They sit with straight postures, wearing their Spiegel catalog best, in oak pews. The church is modern, and it looks like a see-through Roy Thompson Hall. Its clear glass panes allow the Florida morning sun to stream in. It's light and airy, unlike older, dark, steepled churches. Plush purple carpet rolls down through three aisles coming off the pulpit. The minister begins to tell his story. "It's market day, and these two seemingly opposite farmers have hauled their potato-filled wagons a long distance to town." The minister repositions his weight and leans one elbow on the podium, shifting one shoulder towards the congregation. "The good farmer has spent literally hours sorting his batch of potatoes into the various grades of big, medium, and small. He gives them over to the buyer with a weary satisfaction that his job is finished for the week. The good farmer takes the check for the potatoes from the buyer's hands. As he puts it in his pocket, he notices the buyer gives the lazy farmer exactly the same price as he, even though the lazy farmer apparently has not sorted one potato." The minister wipes his brow, smacks his lips, and removes his glasses. He looks straight in the camera, straight at me. "Well, understandably, this angers the good farmer, who has worked so hard for his measly check, and he asks the buyer, 'Why? Why did you pay that lazy farmer the same price as me, even though he didn't sort one potato?' The minister stands up and places both palms on the big Bible sitting on the podium. The buyer responds to the good farmer in a great booming voice, "Because he took the rough road into town." "What?" says the farmer. The buyer says, "His potatoes are already sorted because this lazy farmer took the roughest road to town." The minister pauses and smiles, then continues. "The good farmer still doesn't understand how the lazy farmer's potatoes are sorted, and so the buyer explains. By taking the roughest road to town, this so-called lazy farmer has already sorted his potatoes through the vibrations of the bumps. The biggest potatoes rose to the top, then the medium ones, down to the smallest potatoes, resting on the bottom. So when he got to market, he simply shoveled his potatoes off in that order, and I paid him exactly the same price as I paid you." The minister lifts his arms into the air and raises them towards the glass ceiling 50 meters up. "And folks, that's my point on the power of positive thinking. The potato story is like life. Because big potatoes rise to the top on a rough road. Big potatoes rise to the top on a rough road." As the minister speaks, his words appear on the bottom part of my screen in italics, with the word rough in block letters. Rough flashes many times. Listen closely. When you find yourself in the hardest of times, the blackest of holes, when things just don't seem to be going as planned, you must find the strength to rise above it, to think positively, even on the roughest of roads. Why? Because big potatoes rise to the top on rough roads. That, my friends, is the power of positive thinking. We must all harness that power within and rise above the pitfalls of negativity and become a big potato. Inspired, I clicked off the TV and take my wash to the laundromat.
That was Kate Scroggie reading her story, Big Potatoes. Next, we will hear Pink Chevet, written and read by Kate Scroggie.
The Pink Chevet by Kate Scroggie. The green 1960s school bus chugged and coughed up starting up, then rolled away from the planting site, tires crunching on granite pebbles. I sat in the back, my knees scrunching into sticky plastic seats made for people half my size. After an 11-hour day of planting spruce trees, my legs wanted to stretch, not cram into spaces intended for school kids. I listened to Cindy, our foreperson, call out the names of our crew. "How many did you plant today, Glenn?" shouted Cindy from the front of the bus. 22:50, Glenn called back. "Wow, big day. Dan?" Every day at 5:30, Cindy scribbled our tree numbers down in a ripped vinyl notebook. I hated and loved that moment. Depending on how many trees I planted, it wilted or boosted my esteem. 12:60, Dan called out. "Too many smoke breaks," said Cindy. "Sandy?" 18:50. "Great as usual, Sandy. Kate?" 1800, I yelled. "Good going," Cindy said. Dirt stuck to my face, balls of mud dangled from stray hairs that swung into my eyes each time the bus hit a rough patch of road. I felt the dirt crack as I smiled, putting a cigarette between my dried-out lips. Smokers sat at the back of the bus. I closed my ears to other crews yelling out their numbers. I lit my cigarette and drew the smoke deep into my lungs. I exhaled slowly. Ah, the day was done. One more day down, of fending off black flies and mosquitoes and tripping over branches. It was so cold this morning that some planters urinated on their hands to warm them. By noon, it became so hot, half the people on our bus took off their shirts and burnt their backs. I flexed my shovel hand open, stretching the muscle that gripped tight a handle for 10 hours. I revolved my wrist in a figure-eight pattern, arched my back, and circled my head to my shoulders, back, and chest. I surveyed the windrows of our site. I could make out the plot I planted in. It was marked off by blue and yellow flagging tape. I scanned the trees. The planting lines were cluttered by fallen birch trees and pink granite. The rhythm was still in my head. Pull a tree, dig, whip it in, stomp. 1, 2, 3. Pull a tree, dig, whip it in, stomp. 1, 2, 3. I licked my sunburnt lips. I tasted blood in a crack. My throat was sore and dry. My 8-liter water thermos ran dry 3 hours ago. I searched the floor, greased with mud, and littered with black rubber boots for a filled one. Ahead of me sat Julie. Her thermos was half full. "Hey, Julie, can I have a sip of your water? I'm dying of thirst," I said. "Yeah, sure," said Julie, twisting her neck around. "But it's warm. It's been sitting in the sun all day." It was one of those clear, cheap, plastic bag-type water containers. I sucked the small nozzle. Hotter than warm liquid, tasting like plastic, soaked my tongue. It dribbled down my chin, splotching my finger-wiped T-shirt. I put down the water bag and picked up my inside-out, dirt-covered orange dishwashing gloves I used to plant trees. I pulled the gloves to my mouth and blew them inside out. I tasted muskull insect repellent on my tongue. Suntan lotion and dirt coated my lips. I wiped my mouth with the back of my filthy forearm. I reached under my seat and searched my knapsack for any remnants of lunch. My fingers itched from the pricking the dried pine needles at the bottom. I pulled out half a muskull-soaked peanut butter and jam sandwich in a Ziploc bag. Underneath my paperback, I felt the moist skin of an orange. I didn't have the patience to peel the day-warmed fruit and have its sticky pith coat my grimy hands for the rest of the 50-minute commute. I took out my Walkman and untangled the earphones. I listened to a bad recording of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young's Deja Vu, holding the batteries in the machine. I lost the cover a week ago. I never planted with a Walkman. Some did. I found I lost the rhythm listening to it. There is a town in North Ontario. Blue, blue skies, crackled my cassette. I pressed my forehead to the window and hypnotized myself on the double yellow lines on the road. The buzz whizzed past a town called Sunshine. The relief of a day over settled into relaxation. I watched undulating fields of green pasture, rows of man-made forests 20 feet tall, naked faces of blasted granite, and carless gas stations drift past grime-streaked windows. The late afternoon May sun danced on my face. The bus turned off the main highway and bumped its way along a dirt gravel road. In 10 shuddering minutes, we would be home. Sickly small pines dotted suddenly sterile landscape. This road was more rugged, less friendly than the highway. The old bus whined and twisted around the last bends of the road until finally our base camp came into view. I sighed. Soon a new work rhythm would begin. Hop off the bus, run to my tent, drop off my gear, take a quick dip in the icy stream, scramble to dinner to get what was left in those huge silver pans of the chicken surprise, eat, 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 wash the greasy pastel camp plates in cold, dirty dishwasher water, make myself 3 peanut butter and jam sams, chat quickly about how many trees I planted, brush my teeth, crawl into my damp dome tent, into a freezing sleeping bag, shiver for 10 minutes, sleep, 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 till the alarm beeps at 5:30, and do it all again. I clicked off my Walkman and braced myself for the huge pothole right near the camp. Welcome home! The bus wheezed and chugged to a stop in front of the kitchen trailer, which sat on concrete blocks next to a canvas mash-type mess tent. I smelt tonight's dinner, maybe beef stew. The sun bounced off the placid waters of the lake behind the kitchen. More like a pond, the lake was too cold and mucky to swim in. Even at high tide, I washed my face and brushed my teeth, crouched over in ankle-deep water. Walking back to the shore, the smell of sulfur permeated the air as I sucked my feet from the silt floor. 50 meters from the mess tent stood 3 Johnny-on-the-spots. Not too many planters used them. Bushes behind our tents were closer. At night, a bear scare forced us to hold our bladders till breakfast. Multicolored cubes and spheres are temporary summer homes, hugged an old logging road. I existed in a 3-man tent, barely large enough to accommodate 1 woman diagonally. Flags of sun-bleached blue, brown, and gray jockey shorts flapped from all of the tent's guylines. Straw welcome mats lay at the entrances of some. David Wilcox's song, Going to the Zoo, blared from a distant tune box. As I prepared to get off the bus, I noticed a real car parked in front of the kitchen trailer, a pink Chevette. In my world of summer pickups, decrepit school buses, and all-terrain vehicles, this was an anomaly. An unfamiliar woman leaned against its dusty rose roof. Hand on hip, she chatted with Highballer John. He was always first home because he had his own truck. The woman wore a lemon-yellow wraparound skirt that fell just above her knees. Legs bare! a loud floral print blouse tucked into the skirt. "Hey, will you look at this?" said Sandy from the seat next to me. "It's got to be someone's mother," said Julie, as we stared in disbelief at this skirted woman. "Check out the shoes," yelled Glenn, as we lined up to leave the bus. On her feet were not steel-toed green triangle work boots, but yellow pumps that matched her outfit. The woman had brushed ash-blonde hair, which fell to the middle of her back. It gleamed in the sun. Her face was perfectly made up, complete with eyeshadow, base, and lipstick. Her cleanliness shone. "Nah, it can't be someone's mother. She's too young," said Julie. "Maybe it's John's girlfriend, or someone is majorly lost." Julie and I giggled at the prospect. We pressed the line forward, impatient to get off, and discovered the reason for this clean-heeled woman's presence. Did she have a flat tire? Surely this was not a rep from the Ministry of Natural Resources. The accordion doors clacked open. We spewed out, sticking belly to back. Julie and I strode towards the pink Chevette, parked 25 meters away. I stunk of sweat, mescal, and stale t-shirt that hadn't been washed since our day off in Thunder Bay 6 days ago. Approaching the hatchback, I spotted a cosmetic case, the kind stewardesses use, resting open on the hood. The woman pointed to a brochure with one long red fingernail as she earnestly talked to John. Her red cherry lips moved up and down in time with the waving painted nail. I was mesmerized by their movement. She pursed her lips. She looked perturbed. Suddenly, a wide, knowing expression spread across her face. She smiled and nodded her blonde head up and down. "Definitely a girlfriend," I said to Julie. We watched the skirted woman bend over her toilet case and pull out a long, clear bottle with a blue top. John chuckled. He laughed like he'd been told a dirty joke. He pulled a $10 bill from the breast pocket of his red and black checked lumberjack jacket. John handed the crinkled purple paper to the woman. His hands were black from the soil. John didn't wear dish gloves. The woman picked the bill from his filthy palm with her thumb and index finger. She dropped it in the cosmetic case. It spun down. Julie and I reached the pink Chevette as the woman slid two loonies across the roof to John. "Thanks, John. We'll see you soon," the woman said. "Don't forget to use the sun protector sample on your lips. It's SPF 10. The woman winked a blue shadowed eye. "Don't worry, I love this stuff," said John. John grabbed the clear bottle and a yellow tube looking like chapstick. He rammed the two loons deep into the front of his soiled blue jeans. The woman turned to me from across the hood and smiled, those red lips slightly parted. "Now, how can I help you? Avon calling, ding dong." John, seeing my Avon bumper sticker, pulled me off the highway, knowing the amazing secret of Skin So Soft after bath lotion. It's great against keeping the black flies away, and so much kinder on your skin than muskol. It sprays on and doesn't eat your clothes the way other repellents do. I've just got the 10-ounce bottles left, but two of them should last the season, and I've some terrific new sun milk, SPF 15. You look like you're pretty fair. I'd recommend it. Do you wear a hat?
That was Kate Scroggie reading her story, Pink Chevette. This concludes Life Rattle number 1195. My name is Lori Callis. Arnie Ackman recorded Kate reading her stories. Life Rattle was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman. Tune in next Sunday night at 9 o'clock to hear two more stories by Kate Scroggie.